This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Every Monday after the 11 o'clock news, we are joined by our next guest, a political commentator. You can see him on YouTube. You can read his daily newsletter, which you should be signed up for already. It's called So What? He has appeared on CNN as a contributor for a long time. Read him in the Washington Post. Chris Saliza is with us on KMOX. How's it going, Chris?
Hello. Things are good. It is 65 degrees here in Washington, D.C., and I am ready for baseball.
Well, we're ready for baseball, too. Let's see. We're, what, 2.5 weeks away from the opener? So we're
but only,
we're
I think, 8 days from the games in Japan, the Dodgers-Cubs.
That's
so
right.
I know that's like a preemptive start of the season, but for me, I am one of those, what a big surprise, baseball nerds who loves baseball. So I'm just excited for it to start.
Well, this is a baseball town and this is the baseball station here. So we cannot wait for the opening week to come up. And it seems like all the stuff that's happening makes us want baseball to get here even quicker because politics is just so dumb. And it has, I think anybody who looks at politics right now would have that opinion depending on what side of the aisle you're on. Is it in the first couple of months of this administration? I'm just asking you about general tone, like the way things are right now. Does it feel like anything is different? Does it feel like there are like crazier things are happening, or is this just about what it always is these days?
Gosh, I mean, this is a hard question because it always feels in the moment like, I can't believe this is all happening. But, look, I lived through and covered the first Trump administration. I would say there is clearly, so we're almost 7 weeks in. Donald Trump was sworn in as president 7 weeks ago tomorrow. I would say there is more of a plan this time around than there was the first time around. Now hear me when I say more of a plan does not mean a schematic blueprint that they are operating off of, like, NFL play callers, the first 15 plays they've got, okay, we're going to run this and this and this. There is still the concepts of a plan, to borrow a phrase from Donald Trump, as opposed to a very specific plan, but that is much more of a plan than we saw 8 years ago. So, I think it's one of these things that he did promise radical change, and 78 million people voted for that across, he won every swing state. So, radical change is a little bit in the eye of the beholder. One person's radical change is another person's vast overreach. But I don't think we can be surprised. I would say it is a little bit certainly different than what we would have seen if Kamala Harris would have won, not just in terms of the policies, but in terms of the pace and in terms of the radicalness of the proposals. Look, I don't think Kamala Harris would be proposing Canada become our 51st state, or we take over Greenland, or she would have changed it to the Gulf of America. If you like Donald Trump, excuse me, you like all those moves. If you don't like them, you roll your eyes at those moves. But it is clearly different in kind than we would have had with Kamala Harris.
So right now, I mean, one of the things that is happening, and it's undeniable, the stock market is getting smoked again.
Yes.
I mean, it's down a lot this month. And a lot of it has to do with the uncertainty, because the tariffs, which are implemented, then they're rolled back, then they're re-implemented. We don't really know what's going on here. So it clearly that confusion is not subsiding. But is the feeling in Washington right now that we are headed toward a recession?
Well, I will say, so I'm going through Donald Trump's interview with Maria Bartiromo on Fox Business on Sunday, and she says directly to him, is a recession a possibility? And he does not answer that question, which I would say is not terribly comforting, I think, when it comes to sort of, is this a possibility? Donald Trump, I would say broadly, has always been obsessed with two things. One is television. He is an inveterate television watcher, mostly cable news. And number two is the stock market. He keeps an eye on the stock market, always has. He views it as more reliable than any poll, that it sort of tells him how he's doing. It is down 2.6%. The Dow Jones is down 2.6% since his inauguration. The three major indexes, I believe, are all lower than they were on Election Day 2024. That is not a thing for the economy, and Donald Trump knows that is not a good thing for him. Now, the question is, this is a rubber meets road moment. Donald Trump doesn't have a ton of consistent beliefs over his time sort of in politics and policy, but the efficacy of tariffs is one of the things that he clearly believes in. How far is he willing to go down this road if it does lead to raised inflation, if it might lead to recession, if the stock market keeps reacting poorly to the uncertainty caused by the on-again, off-again tariffs? I don't know the answer to that, but that to me is one of sort of the critical questions of the next couple months.
So how does this work politically? Because people in his orbit have been reiterating a phrase or variations of it, that there's going to be some short-term pain here, but on the other end, everything is going to be great. And short-term pain, I mean, that's fine for people who have money. It's not good for the average person who might lose their job or benefits or whatever. That's not good for the average person. So how is this going to play politically? Are people buying that, hey, I can deal with this short-term pain because everything's going to be awesome afterwards?
Some are. I mean, look, there are some people who just believe that Donald Trump has been right about everything. They literally have the hat that says Donald Trump was right about everything, right? Marjorie Taylor Greene was wearing it during his speech to Congress. But I think a lot of people are getting nervous, for sure. And I think, you know, the way that you can gauge that is, do you start seeing members of Congress, Republicans and members of Congress, saying, oh, I don't know about this, you know, this might, maybe we have to rethink some of this. That stuff is bubbling upward from their constituents to them. There's no question about that. So, look, Donald Trump, if you had to break down why he got elected, I always remind people of this. 33% of the electorate said the economy was the most important issue in deciding their vote. It was the largest chunk of anyone saying an issue mattered to them. Donald Trump won that group 81% to 18% in the 2024 election. It is not to overstate it to say it's the economy, stupid, is why he won. And if he is going to, or Republicans more accurately, because he's not going to be on the ballot again, but if Republicans are going to struggle with the voters, it may well be the economy, stupid, again. I just think you can never discount prices and economic uncertainty as it relates to impacting people's votes. Now, the saving grace, if there is one for Trump and Republicans at the moment, is, look, it's March 10th. We don't have any real elections until Virginia and New Jersey have off-year elections this November. But you know, we're effectively 18 months, maybe a little more, away from the next election, right, the next big election. So we don't know how this is going to play out in the medium and long term. But I would say short term, you're starting to get some antsy Republican elected officials. And unless he either changes his tune on tariffs or the economy suggests, you know, the stock market goes back up, I think people are feeling more optimistic, I think that will grow, not lessen.
Obviously, Chris, there's a certain irony to the fact that economic uncertainty, economic anxiety that has been such a bedrock of the Trump phenomenon now could be working against him, or at least working against Republicans, if these kinds of conditions persist in some way, or certainly if they worsen between now and the midterms, as you say. Do you think, considering that he's not going to be on the ballot again,
mm-hmm.
how much do you think he cares about what is best for the Republican Party, as opposed to I've staked myself, Donald Trump, to these tariffs, and I'm going to kind of ride them out come hell or high water, and what the Republican Party says is secondary to what I say?
Oh, gosh, you've nailed it. I always say to people, Donald Trump wasn't a Republican before he ran for office, right? He was a Democrat, he was an independent, but his affinity for and attachment to the Republican Party is loose at best. Donald Trump is looking at his legacy. How is he going to make an impact in these 4 years? Once he's done, I'm not sure he'll give another thought to the Republican Party, which if you're the Republican Party, let's say you're someone who's going to be on the ballot in 2026 or 2028 in the House, Senate, or a governor, that's concerning. Because Donald Trump obviously has the bully pulpit. He has the most control over what people make of the Republican Party. But he is always has been focused on what is good for Donald Trump, then what is good for Donald Trump again, then what is good for the Republican Party, right? Like, I think that's a really important thing. And Republicans have backed themselves into this corner, right? I mean, they had opportunities to try to break with Donald Trump over the last decade. They either did not take them or it didn't work. And so I think now they may well, in the 2026 election at least, struggle with a political environment he has created that may be fine for him, who's not going to be on the ballot again, but could be punishing for them.
Chris Ciliza, political commentator, is with us on KMOX. Maybe the main problem the Democratic Party has at this moment is in terms of messaging. They have a serious problem there, and it seems like within the party they're struggling to figure out how to reach people. What yes. can they do? Well, first of all, what are they doing wrong, and what can they do to fix it, if anything?
It's so funny. I'm thrilled that I'm speaking. Number one, I love St. Louis. It's my wife's hometown. But this, actually, the story I always tell of the 2024 election about the Democratic brand is actually about Missouri. So this is convenient. So in Missouri in the 2024 election, Donald Trump wins by, and don't quote me exactly, but 18 or 19 points. Josh Hawley wins by 14 or 15 in the Senate. On that same day, with that same exact electorate, right, same people went and voted. It wasn't like they held an election on a different day. Missouri approves loosening of abortion restrictions and an increase in the minimum wage. How can those things be true? And the answer is the only way that they are true is if anything that has a D after it in Missouri statewide is going to be viewed as toxic. But what policies that we would certainly more equate to that be more identified with the Democratic Party, raising the minimum wage, loosening abortion restrictions, those policies can find majority support. So to me, that tells you everything you need to know about the brand problem. For a lot of people who do not live on the two coasts, the Democratic Party represents kind of wokeism run rampant, liberalism to the point of communism, out of touchness, elitism, and that's a gigantic problem, and I say this with the fact with the knowledge that if historical trends hold, 2026 should be a pretty good election for Democrats. Typically a party who has the presidency loses seats in a midterm election. I can very easily see Democrats retaking the House majority. It's a very slim majority at the moment, but that will not solve the party's broader brand problem that I think will bite them if they do not address their problems in states like Missouri between now and 2028.
Chris, just one more kind of current policy question. Last week we saw that I guess it's not necessarily accepted by the Trump administration that they scrapped the plan to sign an executive order dismantling the Department of Education. But that was the reporting was that Trump was expected to do that last Thursday, and he decided to at least postpone it, although the messaging has been that he certainly still intends to sign it. What's going on there in terms of the reasoning behind or speculation as to why he might have decided to delay that signing, and what's the likelihood that that executive order still comes to pass at some point in the coming months?
Well, again, I mean, I feel like, you know, people, maybe Donald Trump has forgotten this, but like, just to be clear, Donald Trump's ability to end funding for the Department of Education, which is the way that you would sort of get rid of it, not constitutionally sound. The way that money gets allocated to the federal government, including the Department of Education, is via the legislative branch, always has been. It's in the Constitution. He's trying to, I think, sort of end run that on a number of levels. I mean, we saw that with USAID. We saw that with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, we've seen it across the government. But I still think that's a fight that is coming and will be decided in the courts, the judiciary branch. Does he try to do it? He may. I think it has long been a Republican talking point. This is not new to Donald Trump. It has long been a Republican talking point that the Department of Education does far too much, is far too big, and really the vast majority of its budget should be sent to the states so that Missouri decides how they want to spend their money on public schools, and Virginia, where I am, decides how they want to, and those two things do not have to be the same or mandated federally. Again, though, I just return to the fact that Congress are the people who allocate the money to the federal government. And I feel like we sort of allied or gloss over that reality. Like, that is a fight. That is a fight between the branches that I think we're going to have. And it's going to be, it may well be decided in Trump's favor, but it has not been yet. And I think that, regardless of what he does, that's really the sort of the thing to look for, whether it's the Department of Education or anything else.
Chris Saliza, good to talk again. We will catch up on Monday of next week. How's that sound?
I told you, I've got that standing invite in my calendar, so I can't cancel it now. I don't know how to. I'm not that tech savvy.
Yeah. And if it's in the calendar, it's just that's what you have to do. It's done.
Take care.
Set. Thank you, Chris.
Week. You bet.
Chris Saliza, political commentator. Catch him on YouTube. His daily newsletter is called So What? And he joins us every Monday here on KMOX.
Still in the air, defensive end for the Galaxy, and there it is. The first St. Louis City SC win for head coach Olaf Melberg. A resounding victory at Dignity Health Sports Park. Your final score, St. Louis City 3, the LA Galaxy 0.
They did it, baby. City SC in game 3 of the season gets their first goal. They got 3 of them. And their first victory of the year. So City SC over the weekend, yesterday, in fact, with their win. And it's a good thing we have Nate Gatter filling in for Amy Mark's course today. I'm Chris Ranji. Nate, host of the soccer show here on KMOX, hosting alongside Jen Cease. And finally, Nate, it's a good win. Needed that win.
Yeah, when you say like,
I said finally, it's been 3 months, but it's been 3 games.
And
three
also,
weeks.
When you say finally they scored, it makes it sound like, oh, they must be terrible, right? Well, I mean, they haven't conceded a goal for 3 games. They haven't lost either.
Let me tell you what's been going on in my life in this show is that every week I have to listen to Amy complain about ties, all right? So it feels like an eternity.
Right. Right. Well, it should be noted now. I mean, it was concerning they didn't score either for the first 2 games, but they haven't conceded a goal for 3 games. They haven't conceded a goal yet this season in 3 games. And now they popped in 3 away against a good team, one that's kind of banged up, maybe wasn't at 100%, but against a good team away from home. I mean, the defending champions, obviously, although they've lost a lot from that team for a variety of reasons. I think there's a lot to be encouraged about. I mean, 5 points from 3 games coming into the year, I think everybody would have signed up for that, especially because there were going to be a couple of West Coast trips there. You know, that's only one home game and an opportunity to bring that momentum home against Seattle next Saturday night and you know, hopefully get their first goal of the season at home, because that's still to come.
How long is it going to take, do you think, to really have an idea of what this team is? Because we had that first really great year, the inaugural year. Last year was almost the opposite of that. And this year, we're kind of hoping they're somewhere in the middle, or thinking they are. How do we know? When will we know?
I think you already know some parts. I think you know a little bit about what Olaf Melberg wants the identity to be. Certainly you know about the way that he values certain things. For instance, Matt Baker, who covers the team on Twitter, and then Taylor Twellman kind of piggybacking off of it, had an interesting Twitter conversation, I think it was last week, taking away comments from training that Melberg made about how the data that they study on their players is really all about, like, the heart rate and output, like, the the players wear what look like sports bras, essentially, yeah. Like those bibs that they pull over.
The biomonitors.
That monitor all their, all their physical activity, the mileage that they're covering, the speeds that they're running, their recovery times, their breathing, their heart rates, those sorts of things. Like, you're just getting a tremendous amount of data biometrically on the players. And that's what's really important to them as compared to statistics like ball winning and ball retention and pass percentage and that kind of stuff. I think what we know about Olaf Melberg already that's not going to change is that he values a lot the shape of the team, the structure of the team. He values that his players are in a position to work really, 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 really hard for the team and be in a physical position to impose their will with the pace and the intensity of the game on the opponent. What we don't know as much is, what is this going to look like when flexibility is required in different game situations, right? For the most part, we've seen them play, really one kind of game in the first couple of games of the season, and then this one was a little bit different. What's it going to look like if they want to knock the ball around a little bit and possess the ball a little bit more? What's it going to look like as they start to rotate when we get into the middle part of the year and there are more games and you have to make more changes in the starting 11 to keep everybody fresh when there are some injuries? How are those situations going to be managed? So I think we'll see the identity. We have some of the foundation, and then we'll see those additional layers get added.
When's the next soccer report?
There will be, it's kind of inconsistent now. There'll be one this week at some point, I think. Just follow Jen Cease on Twitter.
Just follow Jen Cease. She knows. Nate doesn't know anything. He does know a lot. I shouldn't say that. He's great. Thank you, Nate Gatter. Oh, I need to apologize, and I'll do my apology later, but I have to apologize to a listener. That's coming up this hour. But next, Matt Pauly will be joining us. He is back from spring training, and there is a really great sports story happening in the area. We'll talk to Matt about that and the Cardinals when we come back on KMOX.
What did you do for Pauly? Anything?
Me, Pauly, I was responsible.
Pauly, we're here because of you.
Spring training rolls on in Florida. The Cardinals in Grapefruit League play. They will play later on today, actually. It's a 5:10 first pitch. And Sonny Gray is going to get the start for the Cardinals. We'll talk about
it. Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
about Cardinals baseball here in a moment as we bring in Matt Pauly, but we're not going to start there. We're going to start with something different. Matt Pauly, hello, first of all. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, dude. How about these SIUE Cougars?
What a great story. What a fantastic story. What Coach Baroni has been able to do out there in a very short amount of time. They haven't even been a D1 program that long. For Rayshon Taylor, who's a young guy, or is a local guy who came in as a young guy and stayed there, like in this day of everybody transferring out, he stays loyal to SIUE. Yeah, I'm just really, and on a personal note, their athletic director, Andrew Gavin, I've known him for a really, really long time. We were in the South Coast League of Professional Baseball together many, many years ago. We were both in Wisconsin at the same time when he was a D2 athletic director at Wisconsin Parkside. So our careers have just kind of moved from place to place together, and to see him in charge of this athletic department and then be in, you know, where they're at, it's great. You know, Coach Baroni was an assistant at Green Bay at one point. Mm-hmm. I was a broadcaster at Green Bay, so Coach Baroni and I have many mutual friends and acquaintances. So and that doesn't even include the fact that Joe Pott is part of the team here at KMOX, and he's their guy doing the broadcast and doing all the SID work. So I feel really connected to this SIUE program in a weird way, and I'm really happy for them.
It's such a cool story, and as I pointed out earlier, I think of all of the colleges that people from my high school went to, the largest percentage has to be Edwardsville, and for a program that was not in Division I for, you know, most of my life, up until, like you said, about 15 years ago, 16 years ago, this is awesome, because it takes a long time to get to that point where you make it to what is the biggest stage in college basketball.
There are there's a handful. There's a fair number of Division I basketball programs who have been Division I for a very long time that have never gotten to the NCAA tournament. I know I saw some stuff on social media. Might have been our friend Joe Roderick who posted it, but I can't remember for sure. Like Western Illinois, they've been a D1 program for a very long time. They have never won their league. They've never gone to the NCAA tournament. So,
oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, this is
that's interesting.
This is an incredible accomplishment for Coach Baroni and everybody at SIUE.
All right, so we don't know yet when they're going to play. It could be Tuesday in the first four, Wednesday in the first four. It could be straight against the number one seed. What would you like to see happen there in terms of who they get to play in that first round? Would you rather them get that first four game?
You know what, I go back and forth on this because I think there's something special about being able to get a win in the NCAA tournament no matter who you're playing. So if you do end up as a 16 seed, that's why I'm actually in favor of the expansion of the NCAA tournament where all the 16s play against each other in a first four game, not just half of them. Same thing with the final at larges. I'd love for them to do two more games in that as well. So if you are a 16 seed, it gives you an opportunity to get a win in the NCAA tournament, which is, it's only happened once that a 16 is beat a 1. So it's almost impossible for that to happen otherwise. So if they get that 16, I would hope that they play a first four game so they get a really legit opportunity to have a win. I'm not smart enough, and Nate might know better than I, and Nate does know better than I on this, where they would probably shake out, whether or not they're probably going to be a 16 or whether or not it's a 14 or a 15 potentially for them.
I think I'd be surprised if it's not a 16. And in fact, I'd be pretty surprised if it's not in Dayton as it stands. The question, and Ronj and I were actually talking about this morning before we came on the air, the question for them is just stuff that's totally beyond their control, which is how many teams that would be seeded below them end up winning their conference tournaments in some way. So, for example, the Patriot League championship game is going to be Navy against American, and Navy is like a middle-of-the-pack Patriot League team that has a losing record on the year. They're like 15-18 or something. So if you get a few of those teams, and usually there's one, but if you get two or three that end up in that situation where they're in low-major, one-bid conferences, and they were like the number five team in their conference, and they just go on a run and win the conference tournament with a 500-ish record or worse, those teams are all going to end up slotting in below SIUE and effectively bumping them up every time that happens. And I think, you know, their path to not going to Dayton, or certainly their path to getting even a 15 seed, would include probably at least two, maybe three of those types of teams winning their conferences. If we get a bunch of conference number one seeds that are all 20-plus win teams that win their leagues, I'd be pretty surprised if SIUE isn't in Dayton. But to your point, I mean, if I were SIUE, I would be rooting for that, I think, just because, also because of proximity. I mean, it's not that far. It's like a, you know, 4.5-5 hour drive from Edwardsville / the greater St. Louis area to get to Dayton. It's a fun place to play, a chance to win a game. And I think from a marketing and brand exposure standpoint, which is a huge part of this, that means you play in prime time on a weeknight at a time when no other game is going on in the tournament, as opposed to if you're playing Duke or Auburn or somebody on Thursday or Friday and you're playing in the middle of the afternoon, there might be parts of 3, 4, 5 other games going on at the same time. You know, there's quadruple barrel action going on across the four channels that the NCAA tournament uses. And so, yeah, Duke fans are all watching you and you're watching yourselves, but how many neutral fans are watching that game beyond the first few minutes, especially if it gets stretched out quickly as a lot of those games do, and, you know, the number one seed's up by 20 points?
Yeah, I agree.
All right, Matt Pauly, one other college basketball question. We have the A-10 tournament scheduled. SLU is going to play their first game in that tournament. It will be on Thursday. It is a 1 o'clock game, which we will be carrying here. They are going to play the winner of the Richmond Davidson game. Is there a team that you would prefer they play in that first game?
I mean, Davidson, they're basically the same team. Richmond has a little bit lesser record, but Richmond scares me because Richmond has a track record. Their coach Mooney, I have a lot of respect for. So I don't know. I probably lean Davidson, but I think they should be in pretty good shape against either of those teams.
All right. This spring training report is brought to you by St. Louis Composting, growing gardens and making memories. So let's switch our attention to what's going on in Florida. You are back here in St. Louis, but spent the first few weeks down there as the Cardinals got involved in Grapefruit League play. As you left town, you know, and you came back home, did you have any, you know, overarching thoughts about what you saw while you were there?
Thought it was really workmanlike. Thought there was a, you know, just the amount of effort that was being put in by individuals. And I know we say stuff like that every year. It's really cliche. And I've said this a few times. Like, I can be a prisoner of the moment. I'd love to be able to transport myself into previous spring trainings and compare my feelings then to how I'm feeling right now. But it just felt like there was more of that this year, where guys were showing up at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, like a Victor Scott II's out in the outfield working with John Jay, you know, at the you know what crack of dawn every single morning, and then coming in and having breakfast and getting set for what the actual work day is going to be. And I think we saw the fruits of that labor, because Victor Scott has looked fantastic in the outfield, and last year he didn't look fantastic in the outfield. He didn't take very good routes to make catches and everything. So we're seeing that kind of work being put in by just about everybody, and I really appreciate that about this year's camp.
Matt wanted to say butt crack and dawn, but he censored himself. So anybody who didn't know, I'm just filling you in. That's
the you-know-what crack of dawn.
There. That's
you
go. Right.
You know, no, I mean, I didn't want to use that. I wanted to use the other, but I felt like I shouldn't say that on the radio.
No, so probably,
it's been a recent tradition of mine to, you know, without warning Ranji first, and sometimes without really consciously warning myself, try out some words on Chris and Amy that make Ranj say, can you say that on the radio?
Doesn't really happen that often. I feel like you can say anything, honestly.
Like outside of the Carlin 7 dirty words.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are a few more than that, but I wouldn't, you know.
When I was in college, I don't have that. I mean, I'll drop a bad word here and there, but my language is generally pretty conservative. And when I was a program director of my student radio station back in college, the favorite part of every year was when we had our big staff meeting at the beginning of every semester, where I would read through the George Carlin 7 dirty words for everybody, because they would get to hear me say words that generally did not come out of my mouth.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's... I love that you actually had to do that.
We got to track down his old K-State student radio classmate, see if anybody made an incognito recording of that mm-hmm. that we can hold over his head for the rest of time.
Well, you know, it's off the air. Look, you can get away with anything these days.
We could threaten to play it on the air. That's what I mean.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, then we would be in trouble.
Well, but we wouldn't tell him it was a recording. We'd say, we'd just do it in the middle of a Pauly interview and make it sound like he got really mad. Like, we'd get him worked up and then just play the recording and everyone would be like, wow, Pauly lost it. You don't like that idea? I thought this would be right up your alley.
Mine?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm into it. I was waiting for Matt to say something about it.
No, Matt, just enjoying the moment.
Matt Pauly, I know that one of the things that usually gets decided in spring training is that last spot or two on the roster. How decided or undecided are those positions, whether it's a final reliever or a final bench spot?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly undecided. There's, when you think about the final bench spots, it's Lucan Baker and Jose Barrero and Jose Fermin and Thomas Tejesi and Michael Hellman. I'm sure I'm missing Matt Kupierniak. I'm missing a guy or two. When it comes down to the bullpen, it's the Gordon Graceffos and the Nick Andersons and Tekoa Robies and Rodri Munoz. Like, there's, I really think that the final two to three bullpen spots and probably the final two position player spots are still very much up in the air.
All right, Matt Pauly, we, as always, appreciate your time here. What's happening for the rest of the day? Oh, tell us about Sports Open Line, first of all.
Yeah, tonight we've got Sports Open Line. That's going to be just 1 hour leading into the SLU Basketball Coaches Show this evening, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. And speaking of SIUE Athletics, we're really excited because we're going to have Rayshon Taylor on the show tonight during our 1 hour. So that's going to be coming up this evening.
That's really, I know that you saw post game and Brian Baroni, the coach of the team, just as a lot of basketball coaches do, praising the team and praising the individuals. It'll be really good, Matt, to get a chance to talk to Taylor, and we are going to talk to Baroni here in just a little bit, but they deserve every bit of attention they're getting right now, and I hope they eat it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Goodbye, Matt Pauly.
Goodbye, Chris and Nate.
Yo, Pauly, your sister's with me. I'll call you back later. See ya.
We're going to talk to Matt Pauly again on Wednesday. We talk to him every Monday and Wednesday, right after the 10:30 news here on KMOX. As I said, I have an apology that I have to give to a listener who called in very upset, and I'll do that. We also are going to bring to you the egg beat, because we care about you and how much you're spending for dozens of eggs. So every day we are bringing you a new egg story until we've beaten this egg to death. Nate Gatter is in for Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji on KMOX. Nate Gatter and Chris Ranji today. Nate is in for Amy Marks Kors. We do have a conversation with head coach of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville men's basketball team, the Cougars, Brian Baroni, is going to be with us just after the 12 o'clock news, because that team, as we have discussed today, is going to the NCAA tournament for the first time in their history. So it's a really cool story. I am excited for them and excited to talk to Coach Baroni. We welcome your calls and text messages at 314-436-7900. And you can also leave us a voice message on the Odyssey app. I need to make an apology right quick. And here's that apology, Nate Gatter. I think I said earlier in the show that we have been 11:20 a.m. for our entire history. It's not true. It's not true. In the beginning of KMOX, we were 10:90 a.m., and it wasn't until March of 1941 that KMOX moved to 11:20 a.m. And the reason I'm telling you this is because the big news of the day, bigger than anything else we've talked about, the big news of the day is KMOX is moving to simulcast on 104.1 FM starting in 2 weeks. So we'll be on 11:20 a.m., the old trusty, and we'll be on 104.1 FM on March 24th, which is perfect timing because it is a couple of days before the Cardinals season starts. And I am here to tell you that if you've not been listening on the Odyssey app, you can listen to all the Cardinals baseball on the Odyssey app too. Sports, baseball, whatever sport it is, sounds so good on FM. So you're going to want to give that a try when it happens starting March 24th. And Cardinals baseball, you're going to love it. Because we care about you and we care about your egg needs every day until it's time to stop doing it, we're going to bring you the egg beat. Well, Nate, you know that we have been just inundated with anger from people about how expensive eggs are these days. Even if you go to Aldi, it's close to $6 a dozen.
Well, I mean,
it's crazy.
But Trump's president now, so that should be over, right? I just assumed, you know.
Well,
I just been buying my eggs blindly without looking at the prices. I just assumed that it was fixed.
It's funny you say that because the Department of Justice is now looking into egg companies for egg price gouging, which we did talk about last week. But yesterday, President Trump shared an article written by Charlie Kirk. You know Charlie Kirk. He is the conservative YouTuber slash influencer, whatever you want to call him. And he shared an article that Charlie Kirk wrote called "The High Price of Eggs is in No Way President Trump's Fault." He goes on to say that Trump is already hard at work to deliver savings for American families. That's what he says. What we know is that egg prices are very expensive right now.
And do we know what that hard work has consisted of, or just hard work? We have any ideas or policies or actionable anything?
I at this point, I do not.
Okay.
The title of the article is "Shut Up About Egg Prices." Trump is
says
saving
man
consumers
who wrote article
millions.
About egg prices.
Well, here's a. I don't think that egg prices are Donald Trump's fault. They're not.
Probably
and
not.
I think it's probably more so what the Department of Justice is looking into. But I'm glad we're finally admitting what the issue is. Well, one, we knew about the bird flu, so we knew that's part of the problem. But secondly, we know that companies in times like this like to take a little advantage, especially if there are a handful of companies, just a handful, that control all of one thing. Right. So if you have a couple of companies that pretty much distribute all of the eggs in the country, they could toy with the prices a little bit to make their profits better.
Tough time to be a breakfast spot, you know, trying to flip your eggs and make a profit.
That was one of our egg beat stories recently, is that they have been surcharging at certain breakfast spots.
Yeah, no choice at a certain point. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a big surcharge guy, you know, who is, but they really don't have much choice.
But I am glad that we are now finally understanding, though I wish we would have understood this last year too, that companies price gouge. They take advantage of the situation, and they know they're doing it.
We saw this.
They know they're doing it.
The amount of heavy lifting that quote unquote supply chain issues did around COVID, whether that was for higher than necessary prices or just poorer than necessary service, whether it was we're going to overcharge you by 20% because supposedly, you know, stock is short on this thing and we're having trouble with our suppliers, or we're just going to deliver something 2 weeks later than we said we would because, you know, supply chain.
Did you know this? That under federal policy, every time there is a single case of bird flu on the farm, so if there's a farm with a bunch of chickens, they have to kill all the chickens.
Mm.
They have to. It is called culling.
Yes, I am familiar with that word. Yeah.
In January alone, 23 million birds were culled on American farms. This is according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You know what?
That's a lot of chickens.
I know we really love the egg beat music, but I think we do need to have a moment of silence for our 23 million fallen comrades.
Well, this is radio. You can't do a whole lot of silence.
We can do a moment. Chris,
okay.
Ready? One, two, three.
That was a moment.
Rest in peace.
To the chickens?
Yes. Bring them back. Oh, God, they're back.
I don't feel like there's any harm in... Well,
they've risen from the dead.
Hold on. Is it okay to eat chickens with bird flu? I need to find this.
Probably.
I feel like if you cook the chicken, it's fine.
Well, but if that were the case, wouldn't they have like, well, yeah, did we consume any of the, I mean, you can't eat all 23 million, you know, that's a lot.
So here's,
but did we eat some?
Here's what artificial intelligence says.
Oh, God.
It is safe to eat chicken if it's cooked thoroughly, as long as the chicken has not been in direct contact with an infected bird.
Well, if the bird is infected, then it's definitely been in direct contact with one.
Well, it says the risk of getting bird flu from eating cooked chicken is very low. So
but
I guess
not
that
zero.
Maybe it's all. Well, it's not zero.
I mean, let's put it this way. If I had two chickens available for, if I had two chicken sandwiches and I said, this one is $5 and this chicken was perfectly healthy, this other one is $3, but this chicken had bird flu when we killed it.
Yeah.
Which one would you buy?
I'll pay a little bit more, I think,
yeah,
to not have the bird flu chicken. My friends here, Matt Pajeski and Amy, Mark's Coors, couldn't think of her name, but they know this story. I had a roommate for a period of time that did the raw meat diet.
Oh, yeah.
Which did include raw chicken. I watched him eat it.
Oh.
I watched him eat a chicken leg. Chicken off the bone.
And he
I
didn't
watched
like,
him and never got sick. He did it for about a year. Never got sick.
Did he notice any other changes?
Well, he said he never felt better.
Oh. I don't like that because that's a little uncomfy. Maybe
really,
everything I know is a lie.
You can't do it socially, though.
No.
You can't go out to dinner if you're on a raw diet.
Imagine you invite people over for a dinner party. Like, what are we having? Raw chicken.
I think it graduated to him having trays of raw meat all over the apartment when he moved out. Whatever. We got to go because when we come back, we're going to talk to the head coach of SIUE. The Cougars are going dancing. Brian Barone with us next on KMOX.